Jake, great to have you on, mate. I think a lot of people are going to get a lot of value from this podcast. I mean, first of all, you just won the HMO of the year, I believe it is, which is fantastic. And yeah, we'll just talk before this, your journey and what you've done in the last 10 years is incredible. So yeah, mate, I'm looking forward to getting to know you a little bit more. I've seen you around, but I don't think we've had a proper 45-minute chat. So I'm looking forward to it.
Definitely not. I think we met over a curry, right? And
yeah,
on the podcast.
Exactly. Property and Pop It On, just bringing them podcasts together. I love it. And sharing Naab breads, actually. We started the combo, which you do owe me one, by the way. I won't hold it to you. But mate, if you just if you give like a little bit of an overview of what you're doing in property, and kind of when you started, just to give a bit of background and story.
Yeah, cool. So I guess what we do currently, so it's myself and my partner Lucy. So we run a company called Innova Property. We're based in Bristol, and we kind of bridge the spectrum between sort of investors, developers. So we've got an investment portfolio, which is predominantly HMOs, but we've also got a few blocks of flats, buy-to-lets, service accommodation units, everything kind of really. And then we've got a development business that focuses on developing to sell. So predominantly in that business, we're doing sort of commercial to resi conversions, simple flips, a bit of title splitting, some free odd blocks of flats. So we kind of do quite a broad range of projects, but everything really falls into one of those two categories. You know, it's either buying to hold for the long-term cash flow, or it's buying to generate capital to invest in further investments ultimately. So that's what we do now. So everything really is kind of within Bristol. We used to have a bit of a scattergun approach where we'd buy stuff here, there and everywhere, but we decided to just kind of niche down in one area and focus on really kind of a few specific postcodes even within Bristol. It's easier to manage from a build perspective, you know, if you're project managing the development, or you know, we self-manage everything as well, so it just makes everything easier. So that's what we do now. And yeah, like you said, last year we won the HMO Investor of the Year at the Property Investor Awards, which was obviously great.
Amazing.
And back in the summer, we won the Southwest HMO Investor of the Year at the HMO Awards. So it was a good year for us in terms of, very good year for that. And yeah, I think it was just a bit of a snowball effect, really, where we just had a really, really busy year in the lead up to those two awards. And we just had loads of projects to showcase and submit. Which is great. So yeah, that's kind of us and what we do. Do you want me to kind of rewind a bit and kind of
Yeah,
so I guess if I get all the way back, so we started investing or renovating property. I'll say renovating property because we didn't really know what we were doing to start with. So before university, I grew up on the tools. So my background, I was a kitchen fitter, worked for my dad's business, so I was very involved on site, sort of doing, you know, manual labor and renovating properties. So I always had that kind of fascination, you know, I really enjoyed it. I kind of loved transforming properties and being able to step back at the end of the day and seeing, like, you know, you've got something to show for your hard work. And so I enjoyed the process and I liked to be on our site. But then I went to uni in Cardiff, so your guys neck of the woods, and that's where I met Lucy. Yeah. So I met Lucy in uni in Cardiff. And for us, we were living in student houses. So we were sort of sharing with, like, we had an 8-bed student house and a 6-bed student house. So at the time, we were kind of quite naive, but we were looking at what we were paying our landlord in rent every month. And again, that kind of little bit ignorant, because we didn't really appreciate kind of the finance costs and, you know, the HMO licensing and the maintenance, all that sort of stuff. So all we were looking at is, right, what are we paying this landlord gross? We knew that he had at least half a dozen of these HMOs because we'd kind of just been chatting to him. So I think at the time we were just adding up, you know, oh, we're paying him 35 grand a year gross and he's got 6 of them. So times it by 6 and, oh, this guy must be, you know, raking it in. And I mean, he did rock up in an Aston Martin when he came to do an inspection. So that just kind of sealed the deal for us, right? So
interesting. That's like the Rich Dad Poor Dad. I think there was a story where it's a very similar story that it kind of sporadically got him to do it. So that's cool. Sorry, continue. I was just thinking that in my head. Yeah.
so So we were kind of just like, just Lucy and I were just discussing it. And when we left university, we kind of just both sat down and you're like, right, what do you want to do with our lives now? So we said we want to get into property. Like Lucy was also doing a bit of work during university for like, I guess it would be like a service accommodation type business where she was kind of managing a portfolio. So she had a bit of experience from that side of things. And she also really enjoyed like the interiors and the creative side of it. So we kind of left university and we said, right, this is the career that we want to pursue. We want to get into property, but it was just a pipe dream, really. We didn't really have much cash. We didn't know how to do that. We assumed that everybody was obviously, you know, wealthy that got into property and you know, had an edge, really. So we both went down the corporate ladders, both got jobs, both regional based jobs doing, you know, I was in the kitchen industry, Lucy was in HR. But then around the same time, Lucy inherited a property. So Lucy grew up in Tenby in South West Wales. So we sort of sat down and she inherited it with her sister. They didn't want to sell it. It had sentimental value. So we decided to split it into two properties and then rent them both on Airbnb. So this was back in around 2014, maybe even a bit earlier, 2013 potentially. So it was before there was loads of kind of training courses teaching Airbnbs and this and that. So we just kind of got
That's an interesting time. Interesting time for like service accommodation back then, like 20. Yeah, that time. Now it's a completely different landscape of how many people are doing it. People just didn't even know about other platforms then. So that's very interesting. I didn't know about that. That's cool.
Yeah, so we basically just put up a stud wall, fitted a few new kitchens, a few new bathrooms, did all the work ourselves, you know, just working like the summer holiday when we left university, and then rented that on Airbnb. And we've still got it, and Lucy's still got it and still rents it out and still on Airbnb and does really, really well. So we kind of did that. Awesome. And then that was it. We both then went down the corporate kind of careers, you know, working sort of 60-hour weeks for big sort of multinational companies and kind of doing that, really. But then we ended up saving up enough for a deposit. And the only other way that at that point in time we knew how to make money from property was you either buy a property and rent it out, or you buy a property and you sell it. So we bought a flat in Bristol. We were living in Cardiff at the time, but we were both working and commuting across the bridge. So we bought a flat in Bristol. And again, didn't know anything about property investing, really. So we just bought the most rundown looking flat. We assumed it was good value. I think we just paid the asking price for it. We assumed it was cheap because it had like ivy growing through the windows. It had no central heating. it was pretty grim. Moved into that flat. Didn't know anything about sort of leasehold, freehold. We just moved in, started knocking walls out, got a fairly stern kind of cease and desist letter from the solicitors that lived upstairs because we were taking this wall out. It wasn't loan bearing. It wasn't loan bearing, but still, it was a bit of a learning curve. So they wanted all these reports and promises to indemnify them if anything happened, all that sort of stuff. So that put a bit of a, put the brakes on the project, so to speak. But basically, we sold that flat, made loads of mistakes, overspec'd it, but we made a little bit of money. So we made about 25K profit.
What year was that?
That must have been about 2016 or 2017, something like that.
Cool. And then when did you flip it, like for 25 grand? How long?
We probably lived in it for a year, something like that.
So you made all these mistakes and still made 25 grand like in a year, which is not too bad.
It's not too bad. Ultimately, that was probably more than we were both earning individually in our corporate sort of graduate sort of salaries. So actually, it still felt like a positive. So at that point in time, I guess a lot of people and like a lot of our friends, what they would have done is then they would have just rolled the whole, you know, deposit over into the next property and they would have just bought somewhere bigger. But actually, what we did is we split it. So we took that 25K profit and we actually went and bought a buy-to-let flat in Cardiff. So we knew Cardiff, it was cheaper than Bristol. You can't buy anything in Bristol with a 25K deposit. At that time, you still could buy a one-bed flat in Cardiff that we then ended up converting into a two-bed flat. And then we initially got our initial deposit back. And so then we bought another property to live in and we did the same thing. And then we sort of renovated that. So
recycled the money.
Yeah. And it was from a very early stage, it was like a bit of a light bulb moment. So we were like, okay, well, we can use our home as a vehicle to generate, you know, chunks of capital. And then every time we do that, our target was always, let's try and generate enough to give us another deposit for a buy-to-let or an investment. And then we would start combining that with the BRR strategy. So we bought a one-bed in Cardiff. We renovated it. We made it into a two-bed. We refinanced it. We got some of our cash back that way. That goes back into the pot. And then it just starts to snowball from there, really. So that was how it started. And then ultimately, you know, there's only so many times you can flip your own home. We were working 60-hour weeks. We were living in a building site. We were then managing these BRR refurbs alongside. We were also self-managing everything. So we were self-managing the SAs, self-managing the buy-to-lets, the HMOs, the lot, whilst trying to hold down day jobs. And it just got to the point that it was just too much. You know, when we look back at that period of our lives, it was very stressful and it wasn't always enjoyable. But it enabled us to then step away from the day jobs and sort of focus on this full time.
Yeah.
Fast forward to now, and obviously, what we ended up doing is setting up a separate development business for all of the flips and the projects, not flipping our own home anymore. Because ultimately, it's quite stressful, and there's only so many times you can do it before, you know, sort of your lenders and stuff start catching on. So that's kind of how we started, really.
Yeah, nice, man. Yeah. Eve's
hey guys,
dropped
I'm
out,
back.
But she...
I've had major technical issues. I've had to join on my phone without the camera. Hopefully you can actually hear me now. So I've missed the whole story, basically. So I'm going to have
luckily
to
hope it's recorded, which is fantastic. Yeah.
I hope that any questions I ask you now aren't repetitive of everything else.
No.
Do
you know what's really cool about your story is it's like that, when I say typical, it's not that typical story because not many people would do what you've done, but it's that like fairy tale kind of story that you hear that people say, like, I bought a house, I had a light bulb moment, I then recycled it, went through that pain, and then, you know, you've kind of just like snowboarded. And I think it's quite inspiring for people because I think in the property space, a lot of people think, and we've been guilty of this because we're now looking to build our portfolio, but we've probably delayed it by 6 months because, you know, we're in very similar circles, you know, with, you know, Bristol and all these events that we go to, and there's some big things happening and there's all this, sure, you know, sexy things, and people kind of, you know, hover to that saying, I need to go do this. But sometimes just getting started with the basics and sacrificing and maybe making a little bit of money at the first part and, you know, living in that building site, it kind of gets that momentum and direction. And I mean, mate, you know, it's fantastic what you guys have done. It's incredible. So it is really cool hearing that story, and I was smiling through it because, it does remind me of like the Rich Dad Poor Dad kind of vibe, which is cool.
Yeah. I think, there's definitely a tendency to lean towards the shiny pennies and you know, the more creative strategies and the projects with more profit. But to be honest, for the vast majority of our deals have been just quite bread and butter. You know, they're not even the best deals, really. We know what makes a deal good enough for us. So whether that's a HMO, a flip, you know, commercial conversion, we've got our parameters. And if it's good enough, we'll do the deal, you know, and the way that we work is on a worst case scenario. So, you know, if it gets downvalued, if the build goes, you know, over budget, if the time frame gets blown out of the water, you know, if all these things happen and it still meets our like minimum criteria in terms of a return on cash employed or whether it's generating, you know, deposit for the next deal, as long as it meets that, we'll just do it. No, we're not always chasing like these unicorn deals where you're trying to get all your money out of every single deal or, you know, make multi six-figure profits on a single deal. We're quite happy to just kind of plug away doing lots of deals that are good enough.
The way I see you could end up like waiting, right, like years to do one, but you could have made so much more progress, right? So it's like, I think that's, I don't know what you guys said when I was glitching out for like 10 minutes, but like, that's kind of where we're at now in terms of, like, it's so easy to sit here and wait for this perfect thing to make you feel confident enough that you can do it, or you have to have the knowledge and like hear these kind of stories like yours to know actually just getting started is, and keeping it simple, is going to get you there, right? It's like the kind of proof that it gets you where you want to go.
Less risk. And also I think something that we are very aware of is taking action leads to opportunity. So the more you do, the more you buy from the agents, the more deals they bring you. The more deals they bring you, obviously, you know, the better chance that you've got of actually stumbling across that unicorn deal or, you know, that one that one where you can find a creative angle that nobody else has thought of that makes you a lot of money. But ultimately, those deals don't just land on your lap straight away. You've got to prove yourself first, do lots of deals, you know, build the trust and build the rapport with the agents, the vendors, the, you know, whoever it is, before you start getting the really juicy ones.
Yeah, so true. Yeah. I also love the word juicy. I use that word a lot. the juicy deals. I'm always talking about juicy deals. Yeah, it's like, you know, it's so easy to sit in that place of like waiting for, isn't it? And I think you always hear that expression, like you said it right at the beginning before I glitched, like, you know, like it's snowballed, right? Like you use that expression. And I think like even with our business, like you, it's so hard to believe that that momentum exists and that that actually does happen until you experience it, because it's just so hard to imagine ever being, you know, more opportunities in front of you than when you're starting, just trying to find one. And then when that starts happening, you're like, oh wow, like that does happen. So I feel like for anyone starting, it's just like really reassuring to always hear those experiences, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. What was the first project that was like the jump for yourself? So obviously you were doing some more kind of like, I mean, you're doing some kind of unique stuff actually, because you did like a flat conversion into two flats. But when was the, oh crap, we're like, we've jumped up a tier, let's say, in property.
For us, it's probably moving from like buy-to-lets and HMOs. So the way that we run HMOs is we kind of blur the kind of line between like investing and developing. So the reason why we love HMOs is because you can force that capital appreciation and the rent roll so strong on them, it allows you, it justifies, you know, taking these things back to brick. And you know, you can kind of you can factor in the cost of, let's say, side and rear extensions, loft conversions, all this sort of stuff. So for us, the way that we run our HMO model is yeah, kind of we're developing these things and maxing out all the PD rights that we can and converting, you know, 3-bed houses into 6, 7, 8 bedroom HMOs. So I think for us, that was a big jump. And again, because the cash flow is so strong and the uplift potential is there, it also enabled us to start then working with private investors, because you can factor in some private debt into the mix and you can repay them once you come to refinance these projects. So for us, I think that was a big kind of jump from just doing a flip every year, taking the profits, buying a buy-to-let, to then going, okay, this model is scalable quicker because of the finances, and we can bring on board more private investment and do more projects simultaneously. And then I think that was the biggest stepping stone.
Would you have started differently then? Like when you had that learning moment of this isn't scaling fast enough, like if you could do it again or give someone the advice, would you start with the HMOs, or do you think that experience and slower build-up was valuable?
I think the slower build-up was definitely valuable. I think if like the first time we did a HMO, we made loads of mistakes. The first time we did a commercial conversion, we made loads of mistakes. So I definitely think there's something to be said for sort of going at your own pace. And Lucy's probably a better one. She always says, look, it will happen in its own time. We'll, you know, we'll kind of, if we miss out on a project, it wasn't meant to be, you know, we'll grow at our own pace and it'll, you know, it'll be what it'll be. So I think it's definitely something to be said for that. I think obviously if I was starting again now with the knowledge that I've got now, yeah, by all means, I jump straight into the bigger projects, but it's kind of, you can't really compare, because the level of knowledge that we have now compared to when we were super naive and, you know, just done a few sort of our own refurbs is completely chalk and cheese. So I think, yeah, I think I would probably still follow a fairly similar sort of path.
That's interesting, yeah. And I think you're right as well. Like, do you look back in those days when you were doing some of those things, and do you kind of like laugh a little bit, like what you were doing, but like how kind of like fun it was at the same time? Like now it's kind of like a business, and yes, you still have fun, but back then it's kind of like you don't know what you don't know, and you're kind of just like, yeah, look at us. Like that's how I feel about when we started our SA business, like doing renovations at 2 a.m. Now I'd be like hating doing that. Do you kind of get those moments sometimes?
I've got exactly that, where our second or third flip, we were probably working till like 2 o'clock in the morning, and like we had no bedding, so we might have like put like a mattress down on the floor in the corner of this room and sort of slept on the blankets, then got up the next day and done the same thing. And I remember traveling over to Cardiff, it was, I think it must have been like May bank holiday weekend or Easter weekend or something like that. So all of our friends were out partying and we had this flat to renovate because we wanted to get it tenanted and refinance it and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So definitely made some sacrifices in the early days that we we definitely wouldn't do it now because we've got a kid and stuff like that. So yeah, I am quite almost in awe at the work ethic that we had to start with. But then we didn't have the cash to do it. So we didn't have the cash to pay people. So we had to roll up our sleeves and put in that sweat equity. And really, there was no other choice. So we just had to go for it.
That's interesting with the starting out thing in terms of like putting in the hours and not using other people's money from the beginning, right? So is that, am I right in saying that you kind of funded those first ones yourself?
Yeah. So the first, you might have missed that bit. So the first bit, basically, the kind of light bulb moment for us was we would basically flip our house and we would siphon off the profit that we made from that and we would use that to then reinvest in buy-to-lets. And then we'd run the whole BRR model on those and try and pull some cash back and then it would start to snowball from there. So we must have done seven projects by ourselves and then we started folding in a bit of private investment.
What time frame was that, the six or seven?
It's probably over sort of 5 years.
So would you
pretty
say
good,
that...
Because you're working full time. Like, yeah, true. That's pretty good, yeah.
Would you say that it was the only options to do like that? Or if you had known about investors and other options for finance, you would have done that sooner?
Yeah, I think we also had a bit of naivety around private finance back then. So we assumed that nobody would lend us any money. We assumed that we didn't know anybody with money. We were also quite young, so we were in our like mid-20s, so none of our friends had cash, and you know, everyone's just left university with a big student loan and everyone's strapped for cash. So, you know, we didn't think that was an option for us, so we just set about the only way that we knew how. And yeah, it's interesting because we then very early on started documenting our sort of journey and our projects on social media.
Mm-hmm.
And we listened to a podcast years and years ago, and the interviewee kind of said that they raised all this cash through Instagram and we're like, surely not. But what we thought is we'll document the journey and then in 2, 3, 4, 5 years time when we need some investment, we've got something to show investors, to show our credibility. So we'll just document everything that we've done. So we thought if we just pop out of nowhere and go to somebody to try and raise investment into our business or into a project, they're just going to be like, who are these guys? You know, they're going to want to see that credibility and that track record and see that you've delivered all these projects and you've been successful. So we started that very early on with the intention that in the future it would help us. And to be honest, social media has been so, so valuable for us. I don't think our business would be where it is now if it wasn't for socials. And I've got a love-hate relationship with social media because I waste way too much time on it. And there's a lot of nonsense that you see on socials. And there's also, it's very easy to paint a certain picture. And you see a lot of people driving Lambos and Ferraris and painting the picture that property is all great. And you don't often see the downsides of it. But on the flip side, we've met trades, we've met professionals, we've met, you know, other investors and developers that we've then become really good friends with and learned a lot from. You know, so yeah, actually it's been great for us.
Yes.
Love it.
See, Zach, we need to do it. It's like,
I know,
you know,
you
100
know
people can, everyone can tell you, but you've got to just do it yourself, haven't you?
I've literally just paid for someone to start creating reels for me because it's just like, it's one of those things that just drags and drags and drags and drags and you're like, oh my God, got to do it.
Always on the last on the priority list when it shouldn't be.
That's exactly it. It's the last thing. Yeah. If you've got a project on the go or you've got tenants to manage or essays, that is the priority, right? So it always falls down the priorities list, but it always falls down the priorities list and that's the problem. Mm. So yeah, I do it, get up first thing and just do it over my breakfast and put a post up then. Our Instagrams aren't very shiny. I don't think we've ever posted a reel. I've never danced around like TikTok style pointing at figures. It's just projects. It's just documenting projects, refurbs, purchases. You know, occasionally something goes wrong, we document it. And that's all we do, really. But it's just credible. Like, whenever we've needed something, whether it's
so true,
finance, recommendation, we put something out on our stories, and it's always worked for us every single time.
Yeah.
It's funny. It's the same thing as property. Like, you know, some people want to get the shiny content or the shiny objects or, you know, whatever, like make it perfect, but then they just don't even start. And then, again, all you need to do is just go get a buy to buy to let or a flip in the valleys, yeah, you may make 10 or 15 grand, but that's like, wow, it's proof of concept.
Started.
And it kind of it motivates you. But you know what's funny, mate? You said like you did 6 in 5 years, but then I'm pretty sure last year you did that 6 in 1 year, did you not?
15 last year.
Wow.
15.
Yeah, there you go.
So that for everyone listening to that's like that snowball effect, isn't it? That's insane. That's more than people would buy in their lifetime. It's probably more than what people would, like 98% of people would actually buy.
I guess to caveat that, some of them were blocks of flats. So that was like, that might be like 4 flats in 1. So it wasn't 15 individual transactions, but it's 15 properties across.
But that's like part of the strategy though, isn't it? Like buying, why you buy blocks, right? So like this is so cool talking about this stuff, because this is like, I don't know if you mentioned this before I was here, but
yeah, we did. Yeah. Like where we're at, like
this
starting.
Our goal. Yeah. And like building Stay Right has meant like building a business, right? And building a team and building processes. I love that part of it. And I basically feel like that's what we now need to do with like purchasing and just again, like starting the buy to lets, whatever it is, BRRs, and then building. So I want to know what your kind of like systems are and stuff to manage 15 in 1 year. I feel like you're laughing because you
I don't have any.
But there's got to be something, even if it's not intentional. There's got to be a way you're managing that many projects. So, like, how?
I think we need to get the other half on the call.
Lucy's not here because she's running all the systems and processes.
I love that. That's great.
So we work with a VA, so UK based VA. We did work with an overseas VA, but we thought it was actually better value to pay 10 times as much and work with a VA in the UK. I know you guys, that's your thing. But our experience
South Africa.
South Africa.
Yeah. Was yours Philippines?
Yeah.
It's a different vibe.
There you go.
Different, yeah. So Tracy, our VA, we call her our portfolio manager. So she deals with all the lettings admin. She's not based in Bristol, so she can't do anything on site. So we use Coho, which is lettings sort of software, and that's great for all like tenant communications, tracking maintenance, compliance. So compliance is a big one. You don't want to miss like a gas safety renewal or an EICR or something like that. So that has like alert setup and things like that. So from a lettings perspective, there are systems and processes from a lettings, because ultimately you just cannot miss that stuff. It's just too important. From a acquisition, sourcing, project management, build type perspective, we don't really have any systems. We split our projects between main contractors and subcontractors depending on the size. So if we're doing a 200k HMO conversion, it's going to a main contractor. If we're doing a 30k flat refurb, we'll sub it out, because there's not margin in there for a main contractor, and it's probably too small for a main contractor anyway. So that does help us scale in terms of projects. At any one time, you might have 3 or 4 large projects on the go and then a couple of smaller ones. So then we'll kind of split our time that way. But everything, I guess, the more you do something, the more efficient you become at it.
Yeah.
So the first time you do a project and you're trying to write a schedule of works, for example, it might take you ages because you've not done one before and you're second guessing yourself and you're trying to learn on the job. Whereas by the time you've done your 5th HMO conversion that year, it's a copy and paste job from the last one, and then you're just tweaking it based on any variables or differences. So everything does become a lot more efficient, and you're not having to go away and research stuff as you're writing it. You know the answer. So I think it does get easier. So going back to the whole snowball thing, like we might have done like one project in the first 18 months and then one the next year and then one the next year, then it went like 2 and then 4 and then 5, and then it kind of, it's got that, I don't know what that 15. Slope's called.
that's
hockey stick slope,
And I guess as well, like I'd imagine you're like those contractors and stuff, you're building relationships with them. So you don't feel, I'm sure you still check on all your sites, but do you feel like there's a built level of trust there where like managing them has become easier because you've worked with them lots of times? Like,
yeah, for sure. They understand our spec and our standards. We understand how they work and ultimately the pros and cons, because we haven't found such things as a perfect tradesperson build yet. Everyone's got their own kind perks, but definitely. So it was, we always try and do a bit of traveling as well, sort of around our workload. So Last year, we went down to the south of France in our camper van. The year before that, we did sort of 6-7 weeks, drove all the way down to Dubrovnik, and then got the ferry across to Italy and drove back. So did like a whole loop around Italy. During that time, we had multiple active developments on the go, but we were just checking in via WhatsApp, and we had a level of trust that the builders would carry on pushing things even when we were not around.
Yeah, that's so good. It's such a good place to be in. But I think it's so important. Like, now we're talking about where you're at now, but for anyone starting, it doesn't start there, does it? Like, would you say you're doing your first flip, you want to be on site, you know, multiple times a week, like all that kind of stuff, you know, to start with?
Yeah, certainly once a week. If we're around, we'll typically be on site once a week, occasionally once a fortnight, if depending what stage of the build it's at. But yeah, if you're around, there's always questions. There's always things that you might pick up on that, obviously, if you're not here, they might get missed. So it's always preferable, I think, to be on site. But yeah, if it's not possible, you just need to try and have that, build that rapport and have that sort of relationship and have a process in place where maybe the builder sends you updates, you know, at the end of every week, photos of things that they've done, or maybe they do like a bit of a walkthrough together, you know, on FaceTime or something like that, just to see what's going on.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, we did our first, it's not even a flip, but we bought our own house, but it was to live in. And I mean, we learned all the lessons that we've talked about before, but like bad builder off, like had to get him off site. Well, basically, he couldn't go on site because there was just water leaking through our extension in the front. And straight batten walls were plastered wonky.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
So luckily we got a new builder and that was good. But it was so interesting because it's like we made so many mistakes and we had the trust and we probably weren't on site enough. But we learned like all those lessons that you learn if you had your first investment. And it's crazy how quick you pick up. And we're still so far off. Like, you know, what we know
definitely,
we need today.
Yeah, naive.
Yeah, you go, yes, everything that every developers ever said.
Yeah, like, it's all true.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah.
It's all true.
Sometimes,
I do think the thing that helps is that we manage a lot of properties, right? So like, it's not like understanding how a property works isn't brand new information. Like, we manage all the maintenance and stuff for like 70 odd units. So it's not new for like a boiler or a leak and all those things. It's the project management and then all the finance that was interesting.
Yeah, juggling finance can be its own challenge, can't it, really? But sometimes ignorance is bliss, right? Because sometimes if you knew all the potential issues you're about to have with the project, you wouldn't do it.
Yeah,
and
so
we've
true.
Had a couple of projects where we finished a project, we've cashed out of it, we've looked back and we would say to each other, if we were in the same position again, we wouldn't do that project.
Mm.
But then actually we've gone, well, no, hang on a minute, because we learned a lot.
Yeah.
And as long as we still made money, we've learned a lot. And then that's led on to something bigger or better. So sometimes, ignorance can definitely be bliss.
Yeah, and I think like this project is the best course we could have done. So it's worth more than anything else.
Stressful course. I mean, it was to the level of the builder fit the window so badly that we had to render the whole house and spend 10 grand because there was gaps. And I was talking to a developer in Kyle and he said to me, I've been doing this for 20 to 25 years and I still have nightmares, sleepless nights, looking at your windows and how bad they were.
Yeah, I've never seen anything like it before.
Nightmare.
I was like, wow. But do you know what? But this is a good point to turn to like the kind of like, not even the finale, but like, you know, you won the HMO of the year, which is an amazing achievement, mate. Like, when I was speaking to you at that event, you said it. I was like, oh, cool. Is that like a local one? You're like, no, all of the UK. And then you told me who you were up against. And I was like, Jesus, they're like very well-known property people. Like, some that have dozens and if not hundreds of properties. So let's walk through that deal. Because I'm like, first of all, what was that deal? And
what made
how
it
does
win?
Even...
Yeah. Why was it the winner?
Yeah. So it wasn't, basically, it wasn't for a specific deal. It was like HMO Investor of the Year. So I think it was...
So we put forward
a couple of deals. And there are like, you know, HMOs come in all different shapes and sizes, right? You know, you've got student HMOs, professionals, you've got social housing, you've got, you know, sort of, you know, there's so many different ways that you can run HMOs. Some people will use HMOs as almost like almost like development to try and force the capital appreciation and recycle as much money as possible and to kind of grow their portfolio that way. Other people will use them as like a safe and secure like retirement fund. They'll just park cash in them because obviously you've got more tenants paying, so there's less risk of voids, all that sort of stuff, or less risk of you know, the whole thing being empty or anything like that. So there's such a spectrum, and kind of we do a bit of everything, students or professionals, but you know, we'll buy some existing HMOs inside the Article 4. They have a premium attached to them, so you're paying more for them, and therefore the returns are lower. You know, your return on capital employed is lower because you're putting more cash in the first place. Or we go to the other end of the spectrum where we're developing them out and we are buying them super cheap and forcing the value up and then recycling as much money as possible. So we kind of do the whole thing. I think they never told us exactly why we won the award, but I can only assume that some of the reasons were, one, because we have a sustainable kind of growth strategy. You know, we've got a development business that kicks off capital. We then move that across into our investment business, and then we redeploy that into HMOs that we hold, you know, for the rental income. And then even with that, within that, we'll buy some in super prime areas where we're buying for the rental confidence and the capital growth, and then we'll buy others in cheaper areas to hold, run that whole BRR module, recycle all of our cash and go again. So there was one deal in particular that I think, from a numbers perspective, worked really well. And that was one of the numbers, well, one of the case studies that I put forward for the award. So I'm happy to go through that one if you like.
Yeah, let's do it.
So it was in Bristol. Everything we buy is in Bristol, really. So it was quite favorable market conditions for buying. So it was just off the back of the Liz Truss mini budget. So I think that was in October. And if you guys remember, the summer before that was like, it was probably the height of the market, right? So the summer was still super crazy. Everyone was still paying way over asking price for everything. And then the mini budget happened and everything came crashing down. And there was all these fears of recession, and then rates went through the roof and all that sort of stuff. So this property was on the market back in the summer for 400K. And well, actually, was it 375? I think it was on 375. Somebody paid 400K for it.
2023 or 2024?
Must have been 23.
Yeah, it must be 23. Yeah, because that's when Liz Truss. Yeah, cool.
Yeah. Was it even 22? I don't know. Yeah, maybe, by the time we completed the project, it would have been 2023.
Yeah, cool.
So, property sold for 400K. Budget happened. The developer that was buying it pulls out, goes back on the market. They drop the price by 25K. So, it then goes on at 350. We picked it up for 335. Because of nobody else interested. Nobody else was buying at this time. If you listen to the media, you know, everything was all doom and gloom and house prices were going to crash, and there was all this, you know, negativity. So nobody was buying. So we picked up 65 grand cheaper than it was already under offer that somebody else was willing to pay. So there's already like a 20% discount based on 6 months prior built in. So we bought it well. We then kind of spotted an opportunity. So it was on a sort of end of terrace, had a big kind of side plot, already had a rear extension. So we thought, right, we're going to do a side extension and do a hip to gable loft conversion with a rear dormer. So we're just going to max out all of our PD rights. We're going to, you know, go outside, up, and obviously we've already got the rear extension. So we knew that we could turn this from a 3-bed house into an 8-bedroom HMO, and all the building work would be under PD rights. So we did that, got the planning approved. We spent about 230K all in on everything. So that's like the build, you know, furniture, you know, all the fittings, everything like that. And then that one got revalued at 840. So more than doubled the value in the space of about sort of 6 months. And then the gross rent on that one is, I think it's about 78,000. Per year gross rent. So ultimately all of our money back once we've refinanced, and then a gross rent of 78k off the
very
back
of good it. That is why people do HMO conversions, and
that is why people do HMO conversions. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, it's amazing.
Don't
it's
get
a
wrong.
Big project though, isn't it? It's like you can't underestimate that. It's a big job, but like, and all the regs that go into one of 8 bedrooms as well, right? Like, it's what I would call a juicy
yeah
project.
and it wasn't without its challenges. So HMOs, there's a real stigma attached to HMOs. People outside the industry, they don't see all the fancy new HMOs on Instagram. They assume the word HMO means crackdown or, you know, halfway house or student house. And don't get me wrong, it is a student house, but
not like they used to be.
We did an inspection last week, and the place is absolutely immaculate. Like some of the students' bedrooms are tidier than ours. You know, all the clothes are neatly hung up on the rails and folded. And you know, there's students and there's students, right? So we self-manage. So we are very sort of conscious to renovate our houses to a really high standard and offer a really high level of service to the tenants, to the housemates. And on the flip side, we said to them, look, we expect you to respect the house and respect the neighborhood. You know, this is a residential neighborhood. You know, you're not sort of in the city center where you're above a nightclub. This is not that kind of vibe, you know. So we try and really pick our tenants as best as possible. See, you don't always get it right, but wherever possible, we try and pick our tenants and try and pick people we think are going to be, yeah, respectful of the neighbors and stuff. But yeah, when we put planning in for that 8-bed, yeah, we got quite a lot of hate from the neighbors, as you can imagine.
I could imagine that.
But it's definitely changing, isn't it? The whole landscape of like students and the demand for HMOs, like you said, it's very different nowadays. How do you find like with self-managing, is that something you would have you always been happy doing that? Have you ever considered like outsourcing it to an agent?
Yeah. Careful, I know lots of agents, so I don't want to upset the letting agents here. But no, we've dabbled with using agents, and we've worked with some very good agents, very good at the job. But they still, nobody's going to have the same care and, you know, ownership of your properties as you are. You know, so agents still, ultimately, if they're doing, like, let's say a tenant find only service for you, they're still going to be slightly kind of incentivized to put the first group or the second group that come along into the house, right? Whereas we'll quite happily refund deposits and say, no, sorry, this isn't the right house for you if we think they're not the right fit. So, you know, an agent's never going to do that, right? So, we find we can pick better tenants. We also find we can fill houses quicker. So we took our student lettings in-house this year for the first time, and our whole student portfolio was filled, secured before Christmas. And we've got friends who advertise through letting agents, and they're still trying to fill houses now.
Yeah,
and it's because, you know, we can go above and beyond. If a group message us on a Friday night, you know, we think these guys are a great group, and they say they're available Saturday morning or Sunday morning, we can meet them, do the viewing, show them around.
Yeah.
We can get that group secured before the letting agents are even open on a Monday morning. So don't get me wrong, there's a limit. Like if you had 1,000 properties,
that's what I was gonna ask you next. Like how are you gonna scale that? Like what is your goals? I don't know if I missed that part, but like is that scalable what you're doing now? And like is that the plan?
It's scalable to a degree with a VA. So obviously the VA can increase their hours or decrease hours, or you can, you know, take on 2 VAs if you needed to split the work out. Ultimately, the next logical step would be to take on a portfolio manager. So have somebody on the ground in Bristol that could do the viewings and take on some of the lettings work for us as well. Because our value and the value of, you know, a developer is in sourcing those deals, project managing those refurbs, and raising finance. And if you're doing those three things, everything else can be outsourced. Obviously, we like to keep it all in-house because we like to maintain control of it and maintain standards. But, you know, we could train somebody ultimately if we wanted to.
Yeah.
It's cool though, so because
that's part of the plan.
You're growing it like a business. Have you thought about what number you need to get to have that like portfolio manager to build you guys out?
Probably at a level right now where we're getting to the limit of what we could self-manage and, you know, continue growing the portfolio. So I think there will come a time where it's just a necessity, but we'll do it kind of, when we need to, really.
Because it's a lifestyle decision as well, isn't it? It's like, you might be able to keep doing it for longer, but like you said, you've got kids and you like to travel and do the things that, you know, that's the reason you're doing this, isn't it? So there comes a time where it just becomes decision for that as well, isn't it? So what's the plan for this year?
For this year we've We've got quite a lot to sell, actually. So we're kind of midway through quite a few development projects, whether that's box flats to sell or things like that. So we've got 9 projects that we need to sell. So big focus on certainly sort of Q1 and Q2 is to get all of those sold and hopefully complete. So quite a few of them already sold subject to contract, which is great. We've got another purchase in the pipeline, which is our biggest deal to date, which I don't want to jinx, but you might see it pop up on socials in a couple of months if you can complete on that one. But it's lovely. It's quite a challenging one. There's lots of moving parts, it's quite creative. So that's
we'll have to have you back on when that's done to talk through that then.
Yeah, although it's another block of flats, so I don't know to take James's limelight. he's the title split man. One of those. I'm sure there'll be a few HMOs along the way. So with us, it's always a balancing act between capital generating projects and then investment projects. So whilst I obviously mentioned to you guys that project where we got all of our money out, we don't typically get all of our money out. We're quite happy to leave quite considerable chunks of capital in our HMO projects, as long as we're replacing that capital from our development business. So for us, it's always getting that balance. We can't go all out on HMOs because obviously we won't have our own capital to do that. And then you can't really use investor cash because if you're leaving some money in, you've got to plug that hole somehow. So we've got quite a few to sell, one project in the pipeline. We're also doing a few client projects, which is a bit of a new venture for us, but we're doing a bank conversion for some clients. We just got planning on 2 weeks ago for 9 flats. And then we're going to get back in for a larger scheme. We're just finalizing the plans now. So that'll be quite exciting. That'll be quite a big commercial to resi conversion in Bristol. So there's a few bits like that in the pipeline as well.
Amazing.
Nice.
Absolutely smashing it, mate. So last question for me is... the flip market or the property market right now, I think people are up and down of if it's good, if it's not, if you listen to the news, it's bad. But where do you see 2025 as an opportunity for investors?
So for us, we were finding that the flip market is very difficult when it comes to when you're competing with the owner-occupier market, it's very difficult. So if you're searching Rightmove for a 3-bedroom terrace house or a 2-bedroom flat that you can just give a lick of paint and flip it on, you're competing against owner occupiers who don't have the same sort of operating costs that you do. So they're not buying it with bridging, they're buying it with a residential mortgage, there's different rates of stamp duty, there's so many differences that they can pay so much more than you can. So in a really competitive market like Bristol, the margins just get squeezed to the point where it's not worth doing. So we found for us the flips work where you're either doing more creative deals where you can force more uplift, or you're getting bigger discounts on the way in. So whether that's direct to vendor, through agent relationships before things hit the market, through maybe conversions, maybe it's commercial to resi conversion, maybe it's a block of flats that you're title splitting and then selling off because obviously you've got the economies of scale there by doing multiple in one building. So for us, that's been our focus. We've kind of moved away from doing an individual flat or an individual house, unless the discount was just too good to refuse. That's I think what we're gonna, what we have been finding anyway.
Yeah, I think Bristol, I mean, there's obviously areas where it will work, but Bristol, like you said, is particularly competitive, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's very similar to Cardiff, I find as well.
One of the challenges.
It's more similar, isn't it?
When we decided to focus on Bristol, it was definitely harder to find deals to start with, just because there's a lot of developers, there's a lot of investors, there's a lot, it's a very buoyant sort of property market for homeowners as well. So there's just a lot of competition out there. So it took us a while to kind of get our feet under the table and start finding deals, but it was worth it once we did.
Yeah. Love it. Mate, I mean, smashing it. Honestly, it's an incredible story, isn't it? Like you've done the dream of a lot of people in the space of, a couple of years now, but I know you've been doing it for a while. And I think it's really, like, the value of this episode is that snowball effect, and just anyone that's listening to this, that's in property or trying to get into property, that's like kind of like, doing that motion thing and talking themselves down. probably a good lesson for us. I know I'm walking away from this going like...
Not sitting in the analysis paralysis zone wondering. Yeah, there's never a guarantee, right? But you've just got to take that first step. And it just shows that even the way you talk about your plan for this year, it shows that you do just have to kind of keep going and know that it's around the deals you find, isn't it? So you can't predict that. You just got to keep going forward.
Just go business. With it. It snowballs and snowballs and snowballs.
Yeah. And that's very awesome. Cool.
But no, mate, look, honestly, there's a reason why you won that award. I can tell by just speaking to you. You're absolutely killing it. And you switched on and got the hustle mentality where now you don't have to hustle as much, which is great. But
I still do. You still work 7 days a week.
I guarantee you. Yeah, I know you do. Yeah. I know. Yeah, exactly. But no, it's a good kind of story for everyone just to see what you can do when you just commit to something and just crack on with it. And how long was it? How many years in until you were full time in property, both you and Lucy?
Right, so we started around 2014, set up a business in 2018. We went full time in 2022, I believe.
Amazing.
So 4 years after we set up company up, but sort of eight years from our first sort of refurb, really. Mm. But sort of, yeah, a few of those were working the corporate job.
Yeah, working on a job very young, not having done any real training, right? Like, it's awesome.
Never done any formal training. No, we've kind of
no
networked. 15K. None of that. Listened to a lot of podcasts, networked with the right people.
That's such a big thing.
The relationships that you have within the industry are key. So every one of those strategies that I've mentioned that we're doing, we know people are doing them much better than we are. You know, we're not the experts. You know, when we get a deal, we'll go to them and ask their help and ask their advice and run deals past them. And when we get stuck, you know, if we're midway through a project or got a challenge with legals or planning, we'll just speak to the people that have done it time and time again, and they'll give us the answers. Yeah,
yeah, I found that. Yeah,
there's that book there, Who Not How. It's that kind of principle, really. Sitting up at night trying to research the internet where there's loads of fake information, just speak to the people who are actually doing it. They'll make the connections. They'll open the door for you. They'll give you that one snippet of advice that just solves all your problems. And I think that's how we've done a lot of the projects that we have, and how we have the confidence also to take on some projects where maybe they're like a little bit outside our comfort zone, but actually we're like, oh, well, we know X, Y, and Z who do these all the time. Yeah. So, you know, they'll help us.
So much power in that. We always have to remind ourselves of that. It's like, there's actually so many people around us. You got to use it for sure. It's very cool.
You underestimate how many people you know, yeah. But look, mate, this has been a fantastic episode. Honestly, 2025 is going to be an insane year for yourself. And I expect there to be 20 properties, not 15. So
I'll let you know at the end of the year.
Yeah, we'll have you back on in the year, mate. But where can people find you if they want to come look at your glorious professional social media that you talk about?
Well, I wouldn't call it that glorious, but Instagram's where we spend the most of our time, or LinkedIn. We don't spend too much time on Facebook. I find Facebook's full of forums with people arguing and giving wrong information. So yeah, Instagram and LinkedIn probably.
Awesome.
What's the? We'll put the tags in the bottom of the chat. But
Innova Property.
Nice, cool. Well, look, mate, it's been great having you on. Keep smashing it. It's inspirational, and I'll see you at the next event where you owe me a number at. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, cheers, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
No worries, Jake. Take care.
Cheers.